Miss Pierce, reel 20.
And as the British military train was coming through, a very sensible corporal realized exactly what was happening. He guessed that she was, you know, American, whisked off the train. And he just leant out before the train had completely stopped, and he said, British, I presume, and whisked her onto the train and unlocked an empty officer's compartment. You know, they had sleepers. And his job was to collect up all their passes. They weren't disturbed during the night. And a sergeant collected up all the men's passes, and they dealt with the Russian authorities with these passes. And he just locked her into an empty sleeper. And that was how she got saved. And the train went on into the British zone, and she was duly delivered safe and sound back to the Americans. I gather she had a ticking off, because whatever she did was indiscreet and caused this danger to herself. Almost an international incident.
And tell me about Malaysia.
Well, while I was in Vienna, I managed to break my foot by moving some beds one Christmas to get the patients up to a party. And they were those kind of folding army beds, which the legs fold up underneath. And I'd pulled this bed along and let go, forgetting that the legs would be folded up. Luckily, I had my snow boots on, but I did break my foot. So when this happened, it was decided that perhaps it was time that I went back to England. And whilst we were debating this, one incident I must tell you about, which I think you will find rather interesting. There were always refugees coming from Hungary into the different zones, and they used to make their way to the British zone. They were always escaping from the Russian side. And two men came to the sisters' mess where I was staying, and asked for help. They were frozen. And we were forbidden by the military police to feed them or do anything for them, because the Russians were literally training their spies to starve and to look like refugees and get through. However, these were so pathetic that matron came along and she said, oh, take them down to the kitchen and give them something to eat. And we discovered that one of them had only a thin overcoat on and had nothing on underneath at all. And they told us that they had been 10 days in Vienna since they'd escaped. Because in the different zones, on all the doors that where we lived, were the flags of the occupying force, a little paper flag stuck onto the door inside the glass. We'd got an ex-Nazi's house, and the Union Jack was stuck there. And they'd been looking for a British Union Jack on the doors. And eventually they found us, and we did feed them, and then we handed them over to the British military police. It's just to give you an idea of what went on there. Well, meanwhile, I'd done this, and it was thought that I should go back to England, and then a telegram came addressed to me. Would you accept Far East posting? I had already been in Egypt with them and done quite a lot there, but it wasn't very exciting, not at all the sort of thing that the Imperial War Museum would like. It was more or less peacetime occupation forces. So I got back to England. We had... the snow was very bad that winter. It even snowed in Vienna, which is quite an unusual thing. So the train was stopped several times as we went through Switzerland. And I tried walking. I was determined that no one at the other end was going to know that I had got these fractures in my foot. I was going to have my Far East posting, whatever happened. And I'd already met Lady Louis when Mountbatten, when we were in Egypt, and Dawd working for her as St. John Red Cross officer, and I knew that she was coming to the Far East in one of her tours. So anyway, when I got to the London office, I realized there was just enough room between me, the door, and the desk so that I could walk without looking as though I was limping. And I pulled myself together, and it was still winter, so I'd got some nice warm boots on. And I managed to walk to the table and sit in the chair and be duly interviewed and told what was expected of me and all the rest of it. And I thought, now the only thing is, are they going to send me for another medical? I did have one in Vienna. And she said to me, by the way, have you recently had a medical? And I said, yes, I had had. As a matter of fact, my passport had expired whilst I was in Vienna, which is another thing. And I've kept that historical passport that I got afterwards because I had to go to the embassy and get a new passport. So I'd had to have a medical. Forgotten why, but I'd had to have a medical. So I told her this. So she said, oh, well, that's all right. We won't waste time with a medical. So I was able to hide the state of my foot and was flown out to Malaya. In those days, flying took longer, though we left at 8 o'clock Monday morning, and we were due in Singapore Wednesday, which wasn't bad for those days. But on the way, we had an engine failure. We put down at Calcutta before the engine failure, but were not allowed ashore because of a smallpox epidemic. And then we put down at another place. I can't remember where it was. One of the official stops, and had to stay there. But instead of taking off after we'd had a meal and a wash and brush up, we had to spend the night there till about 3:30 a.m., which delayed our journey for the engine failure. Well, eventually we got to Malaya, and we had been warned before we went that we would feel the difference and we would be very tired from the freezing cold into the heat. And that was so. And of course my foot, I remember walking across Rome aerodrome, we did put down in Rome, and the tarmac was not tarmac, it was sort of metal ridges, and these were twisting my poor old foot like anything. However, we did manage to get a tour of in a bus of Rome, and were forbidden to go ashore. Our passports were all taken from us. Well, can you imagine it? There were a lot of us that were Catholic on that bus. There were Americans, there were Australians going back to Australia via Malaya, and there were all sorts of people there. And as the bus slowed down in St. Peter's Square, one of the Aussies threw the door open and the driver had to stop. The driver was willing, but the man that was with him, wasn't at all willing, and we all went out. And we rushed in to St. Peter's and had our visit to St. Peter's and back into the bus again. I was more or less carried because I could hardly walk by then. And we got to Singapore. Of course, it was in the early 50s, 51, 52, when the bandits were very much in action. And our boys, our lads, were getting very wounded and mutilated and had long jungle warfare. So that our military hospitals, I was attached to a military hospital there. I had been at FIDE attached to an RAF hospital. But I was attached to a military hospital. And it was full of wounded and fever-ridden lads who'd had weeks and weeks in the rain jungles and the other jungles fighting the communist bandits. The irony of this early part of the bandit warfare was that when we liberated Malaya from the Japanese, I gather that as our forces went through the different villages and jungle villages, they threw arms down to the villagers and were teaching them how to use them against the Japanese. And these now had become the bandits who were attacking us, taught by us. And it was one of the things that you must not be caught prisoner, because they mutilated their prisoners and treated them so badly that death was preferable to being caught by these bandits.
Did you have some of the people who'd been caught by bandits as patients?
Yes. Mostly they died or killed themselves in time, but we had some very badly mutilated men. And they were so young, you know, these boys, these young men that were fighting. They were in their 18s, 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds. And they were most dreadfully mutilated. I needn't describe the mutilation that was inflicted upon them. And their mental state was terrible after it, so that it was always advisable, and they always tried to work it, that they died rather than be caught. And I remember so well on one occasion one of their whole lot of boys we had in, and one of their members was found dead upon the road after mutilation. You see, very few of them came into us as patients, because once they'd done that, they killed them and then left them lying in the middle of the road to be found, which was very unnerving for all concerned. And the colonel rang through to me, to my department, and he said, can you do anything? You're nearest the mortuary, unfortunately. And he said, come and pass through your department, and they'll come and try and go there to visit their, you know, to be near their pal who's been brought in. And we don't want these patients to get into this morbid state, so will you see if you can put an entertainment on in your department to try and stop them going up through to the morgue? It was a very difficult afternoon, I remember. And on another occasion, a young officer, he'd been married a year, was on his way down to Singapore on the train when they raided it. You see, they used to raid the trains. They used to attack us on the road in the cars. We had to go at a steady 80 at the very least when we were going through the areas between the towns to try and avoid them. Well, on this occasion, the train was attacked, and he was shot as he lay in his bunk and killed. And he was on his way to meet his wife, who had come out from England to join him. It was terribly tragic. And she was, they had the funeral somewhere on the way down, and she went to it. I think it was the most dreadful thing. And then there was another young officer who was killed. He had only been married about 6 months. And I went to the funeral, and the colonel said, could you represent his wife? There were all sorts of occasions like that. And I remember passing by the open grave, and I broke off a flower off a bunch that someone had managed to get. I think they must have been gardenias, because we had masses of gardenia bushes. I used to fill the department with gardenias every morning, practically. And I picked off one of the gardenias and dropped it into the grave, and I said, this is from your wife. And they thanked me afterwards. It was only a little thing to do for a poor soul that was only 6 months married. And it was, Malaya was a terribly tough assignment for our troops.
Because you won't tell me what the mutilation was, I assume you mean they were castrated?
Yes. Yes, very badly so. And you can imagine that they preferred death to that. And also they were disemboweled. And other things that I was never told about. In fact, to me, most of this was guesswork, excepting those that happened to come in as patients, which was a very rare thing. Then I knew from the sisters on the ward what was wrong. And another thing was that they needed welfare a tremendous amount. And very often a lad would do something to his thumb or something and go to the adjutant and say he needed to go to hospital. And the adjutants were very understanding people. And they knew perhaps that this particular case they were trying through red tape to deal with family troubles. And it took a long time for them to get news of what was going on, perhaps the wife being unfaithful, the lad was imagining that the wife was being unfaithful. And so they would let them come into hospital because then we could take over. We couldn't otherwise, not unless they were patients. And we could do things far more quickly through the Red Cross and St. John in England, and they would go and get visitors and report back, you know, and write back. Sometimes it was imaginary and we were able to bring back the good spirits of the soldier concerned. At other times the news was what they expected. And of course they couldn't just be sent home like that, not as easily as that. And we did a tremendous amount of welfare to not-so-ill patients and very ill patients. And then we had installed in our hospital, I suppose what you would call now a closed-circuit radio, wireless apparatus. So I went to the colonel one day and I said, I've been talking to the men as I've been taking the books round, and they would love someone to read them serials through on this. Can we do so? Because it comes through onto their earphones and their beds. So I took to reading them a serial every day, and believe it or not, Westerns seemed to be the most on demand, and Agatha Christie. And I used to shut myself in this boiling hot, because the heat of Malaya is terrific, and this was an iron sort of thing, you know, with glass. And I shut myself in there and read to them for about half an hour on end at different times of the day. And then we tried to get someone to play a musical instrument, but it was a bit loud in there. And I tried to get some of the civilian wives to come and talk to them on the closed circuit. And a lot of the civilian wives used to come, the, what did you call them, DO, district officers' wives, and any ones that they knew, you know, any civilian wives attached to the different rubber fields that they knew would come, talk to them and tell them about things, and that gave them something else, because we didn't have, of course, such things as television or anything like that, you see, to entertain them with. And the civilian wives were awfully good, and they used to ask the men out to tea to their different houses. And the DO's wife was marvellous. She used to have tea parties for them, and even curry tiffins and all sorts of things like that. Of course, if you were asked out to lunch on a Sunday in Malaya in those days, I presume it's always been the same when we've been there, it was always curry tiffin wherever you went, with gulu melaka as sweet. Now, I don't know if you know what gulu melaka is. It's a dessert which is made out of oh, not semolina, tapioca. It's some kind of mold made with water out of tapioca. And there is a lovely syrup that comes from Malacca. And you have this poured over it. And the sweet was called Gulu Malacca, which I presume Gulu was a Malay word, which meant tapioca. I don't know. But you had that everywhere. But if possible, if you went to Penang in order to avoid all these dreadful, risky bandit attacks, because when I was down in Johor State, I started off in Johor State. It was pretty bad there, but when I was posted up to Kamunting near Taiping, further north, the bandit raids were very bad. They didn't suffer from it down in Singapore. I went up to Alor Star and almost up to the Burma-Siam border. But you had to do everything at such a tremendous pace because you didn't stop or slow down because you could be attacked. And the only respite you got was to fly a 20-minute flight up to Penang, lovely Penang Island. And there was a little island off Penang where the lepers and the TB patients were kept, because by that time they had known that it was the same drug that cured the two. And the school children used to go over and entertain the lepers, because they're not contagious, only at a certain stage. But there isn't very much more I can tell you, excepting of the horror that the men went through, the terrible privations that they went through in the jungle, and the malaria, and the dysentery, and the different diseases that they all were in hospital for. We didn't escape, of course, dysentery and all those things, and the terrible worms that you caught out there. We didn't escape those things either. So as well as them contending with these bandits, they had to contend with most terrible illnesses, which they came into hospital for.
I should think that if you're a soldier wounded in wartime, at least you could feel you're doing your bit to help your country. Whereas if you're in Malaya, that would be rather different psychological state.
Well, psychologically, it all seemed to be futile. What they were doing was protecting the rubber fields and the various civilians. Countess Mountbatten, Lady Louis, had a wonderful idea. She wanted to, you see, they were forever evacuating from the villages so that the bandits couldn't get at the wives and influence the families towards their mentality. And so they were brought out into camps and away from their villages, and they lived a sort of semi-concentration camp life so that the bandits couldn't get at them and brainwash them. And Countess Mountbatten had a plan, which I never quite knew whether it materialized or not, whereby she would take some of us and send us into the camps to do welfare among these Malays. And she was due to come and visit us. As you know, in 52 the king died, and our present queen had to come back from where she was in Africa. And Lady Louis was due to visit us at that time, and she had to put it off because she had to meet the young queen and Prince Philip off the plane when they came back, because she was their aunt. And then she came out to us. And when she came up to Kamunting, she took me on one side and she said, "Pierce, I've got a plan for you. I can't yet discuss it because I've got to put it through the house. But our chief welfare officer for Malaya told me afterwards that this was the plan, to put some of us into the camps to do welfare among the Malays, among the Malay families that were there. Because, you see, they were being so got at by these bandits, so influenced, and we had to get them away, otherwise the whole of Malaya would have become communist. And, well, I didn't hear much more after that, so whether she managed to get the plan through the House or not, I don't know. But she was very, very keen and very interested in the natives of all the countries that she went to. As you know, she was absolutely marvellous, because I remember on this occasion when she visited the hospital, the colonel had had the usual sort of wash and brush up of the hospital and set places painted with this, that and the other, you know, to make it all beautiful. And he had decided which places she would see and which places she wouldn't. I never warned any of them that they didn't know Lady Louis as we did, who worked for her, but that she would certainly see everything. She wasn't going to miss anything. Well, he'd got all the sweepers in the background. They were around the backs of the buildings. And as we were going down the... You see, it was all open. We didn't have air conditioning. I presume things are different. Well, then we're not out there now, are we? But the corridors were all open corridors, and the tops of the wards were latticed so that air sort of spread through, and fans everywhere. Well, we were going down the main sort of open corridor, and Lady Louis turned round to me and she said, "Josie," she said, "where are the sweepers? Must be sweepers here." And the colonel was getting embarrassed, and, you know, they were, and the matron was embarrassed. And I just looked to the side of the building. She knew what I meant. She said, "I expect they're round the back." She darts out of the cortege that was with her, you know, and she goes round the back. And I don't know how Lady Louis did these things, but she managed to speak to them in their language. And she chatted with them. And then she turned round to me a bit later as we were walking down the passage, and we'd skipped a ward. There were boys who hadn't been very good, and they were all pushed into that ward, you know. And it hadn't sort of been tidied up tremendously, because she wasn't going to be shown that ward. That was their punishment. And she said, "What's this door shut for? This is an empty ward." And I said, "No, Lady Louis, it's not." I was in my element, because I wanted her to go and chat to these lads, so she went in. And she went straight up to one bed and she said, "Malta, wasn't it? 3 years ago. What are you doing in bed again?" She knew people. She was an amazing person. She never forgot. And yet all the thousands and thousands of people that she met and all the service hospitals that she visited. But she knew at once that she had met this man. And then as she went through the ward, she recognised others that in other places she'd come across. Well, as we were going down the corridor and we came out of this, she said to me, "Josie," she said, "this is an area where there are a lot of Gurkhas, isn't it?" Oh, I said, "Yes, and we have the Gurkhas. They're wonderful people." I said, "We've even got a Gurkha kitchen, so that they have their special food." Colonel was livid. Apparently he'd arranged that she was bypassing this kitchen, you see. So she said, "Where is it?" Well, I said, "It's straight up here," pointing to the direction. So off goes Lady Louis and everybody following on behind, matron looking daggers and the colonel not too pleased. And she went into the Gurkha kitchen and she sampled some curry. And of course she could speak their language. And she spoke to them in, Nepalese. And then she went to our kitchen, but she didn't spend much time in there, but she spent a lot of time in the Gurkha's kitchen. By the time she'd finished the visit of that hospital, I think they'd all learnt that Lady Louis was a person that you didn't bypass at all in anything. She was all there, and she went for everybody. She went to see everybody. She didn't just come to see specially set out places or offices or anything like that. She was for the lowest of the sweepers, for the, you know, everybody counted. She was absolutely perfect with everybody. And of course we would have gone through fire working for her. We were so proud to be her little elite unit, as it were, which is still going strong, of course. They still have St. John and Red Cross welfare officers in the different service hospitals all over the world.
Tell me about the time you actually saw the bandits.
Oh, yes. I was invited by people called Mr. and Mrs. Crosby, who eventually retired to England. I don't know what's happened to them since then, because they weren't young. They had vast rubber fields, and he was either he owned them or was managing them. I'm not quite sure which. And they'd invited me down for a weekend, and I went there. It was in Johor State, and they decided that on this particular day, Saturday I think it was, they would take me by jeep to see exactly how the latex, it is latex it's called, isn't it?
That's a kind of rubber.
That's right. How it was put through the different machines. It was actually done on his estates. And but he had to warn the military of his movements, because they were very much in danger, because the bandits were everywhere through the rubber fields, and they used to slash the trees, and it's like milk, you know, the latex would come out, and the whole thing would be ruined. So we were going through, and all of a sudden his Malay driver said quite quietly, "Tun," and something in Malay, and he muttered something back to him in Malay. And whilst he was saying that, I was looking at what I thought were Gurkhas walking away from us among the rubber trees. And I said, "Oh, look at those Gurkhas going away." I said, "You are well protected." And he didn't answer. And the jeep was very quietly turned round, frightfully quietly turned round. We went back the way we'd come from. And as we neared his home, back to his guards, he said, "Your Gurkhas was a whole band of communist bandits in my rubber fields. And we were almost caught by them. Luckily, they had their backs to us, and for some reason or other, they didn't detect us." So that was the sort of life in Malaya. You never knew what to expect next and what was what. They'd put themselves in uniform, and they looked very much like Gurkhas.
Were they far away from you then?
No. I mean, if we could see them in the thickness of the trees, I can't remember how many hundred yards they were away from us, but I mean, they were near enough for us. If we'd called out, we could have spoken to them, shouted to them.